Hey, how's it going? Welcome to the Football Diary podcast. This week, we've got Forest fuming after their controversial defeat to Liverpool, Aston Villa flexing their bench to see off plucky Luton, and is Muniz the new Mitrovic for Fulham? But first, Manchester derby. Let's start there, shall we? Let's get it out of the way. City 3, United 1. There's almost a grim inevitability about the result, wasn't there really, Dave? Even after Rashford's stunning opening goal quite early in the first half. And despite Erik ten Hag saying that United were very good for 27% possession and one shot on target all game. Are you deflated by this defeat, Dave? Or are you just glad the game's out of the way now?
Not really. I'm not surprised in the manner of the defeat. I'm more surprised that we actually took the lead, to be honest. Because the way that we performed going forward, especially without Højlund, obviously, once he got injured, that was a massive blow to us. Having someone in there who's really struggles to keep hold of the ball and hold the ball up, that is something that we did miss in this game. So I'm not entirely disappointed as such. Obviously, it's annoying to lose any derby game, but yeah. I think many kind of expected probably the worst, to be honest. So.
Yeah, I think based on expectations for most Manchester United fans, we kind of predicted maybe like a 3-0 or something like that. So I think it's the hope that kills you as a United fan. Taking the lead, you think, yeah, maybe there's a chance. And do you know what? United could have gone 2-0 up at one point if Rashford's finishing was better. Mm. However, I think I always felt, Miles, that City had it in them to unpick United, trying to be stubborn and resolute in defence, which they did for large parts, I thought. Mm. But Phil Foden stole the show, didn't he? Such a memorable performance from him. Probably one of his best for City, I think it's fair to say. And Pep Guardiola's called him the best player in the Premier League at the moment. What do you think made this performance from Foden so special?
I think you could see the Manchester in him, actually. This game clearly means a lot to him. He did well, obviously, in this fixture last season, got himself a hat-trick. So two goals here is massive. And I think the freedom that he's been given in this City team this season makes him the new star of it almost. We've been kind of waiting for that opportunity for Foden to blossom and be City's main man. And the injuries to De Bruyne and Haaland meant that he found that run of form where he could be. And actually now you'd argue that he's one of, if not the most integral player in the squad. Mm. His performance this season, I think, is worthy of the praise that Guardiola gave him to say that he might be player of the season worthy. And going into the Euros, that's massive, because when you've got someone like Saka performing so well at Arsenal and then Foden, that's two really amazing young prospects that could really carry this next generation forward. So yeah, it was incredible for him because he just didn't seem to want to give up in this game, and both goals indicated that really well.
Yeah, the goals were both fantastic. The accuracy of the finishing for the equaliser as well was superb, and I think that's what makes him almost stand apart as a player that's been, if not world-class already, then definitely on the cusp of it, is just that ability to rise to big occasions like this. And obviously he's done it in Europe as well. And there's a good chance for him to do it for England too at the Euros. What's his best position though? Because I know when De Bruyne was out, he played centrally quite a bit and did really well there, to be fair. He often drifts wherever he wants to go, and he played wide right on this occasion, Dave, but that's obviously Saka's position for England. So where can you see him featuring more frequently for club and for country?
Well, he says he prefers central, more central role, doesn't he? And that's a thing for me. If he's going to play centrally for England, I think England have to change their system they have to sacrifice one of the midfielders, because, let's be honest, I can't see Southgate playing him in midfield. He's already made that very apparent by, you know, giving... He always seems to favour him on that right-hand side, which, let's be honest, he... So I can't see him playing in a field. He's going to have to change his system for me if he's going to play centrally for England, which, you know, is very unlikely. So it looks like it's going to be him or Saka on that right-hand side. And I do love Foden. I think he offers a lot. I think he's a very different player in terms of profile to Saka. Saka's, you know, he can exploit that space in behind, whereas Foden's more that sort of player to unlock the defence and create opportunities. It's great to just have the
freedom. It's the balance for me that makes him so versatile, isn't it? I think the way he keeps the ball, runs with it and can change direction means he can play almost anywhere across the front.
Well, we saw that in this game as well, because you're right, he started on the right-hand side, but look where he gets his second from. He comes in from the left and puts it across Onana. So that's really encouraging, the fact that he can pick up those pockets of space wherever it needs to be. You want the best attacking lineups are fluid these days because it challenges the fullback to think about multiple things. And the way that Saka would play on that right-hand side compared to Foden is obviously very different because we know that Saka likes to cut into that left onto that left foot. If you then can swap that round through the game, then that's really effective. He's not going to occupy the central role for England because Bellingham will be there, but he's proven at City this year that he will contribute from anywhere on the pitch. And that's a massive asset for City as they run in for the title and England when they go into the Euros.
Yeah, stunning performance from Foden and I guess reluctantly another really impressive win for Manchester City in another derby game, and United's dry run in this fixture goes on. I can't say I'm surprised, but the title race continues to be quite exciting. Liverpool beating Nottingham Forest with a 99th minute winner from Darwin Nunez under really controversial circumstances. And I think when there's so much riding on this game for both teams, isn't there, at both ends of the table, when it's decided on a goal that deep into injury time, and as a consequence of what looks like a refereeing mistake to stop the play and give the possession to Liverpool when it was actually in Forest possession when the game was stopped, that's got to feel really aggrieving for Forest fans and for Nottingham Forest as well. I know they've got Mark Clattenburg on their books to kind of fight their fight for them with the referees at the PGMOL. But I mean, if you were Forest, would you feel aggrieved by this? Do you think they're right to feel angry?
Do you know what I noticed though? I don't want to sound like a hypocrite here because we often bemoan players like getting in the ref's face and being too aggressive. But in that passage of play, Forrest, I think, should have had a penalty. I think Gomez has made a foul in the box that VAR obviously looked at and kind of waved off. And there were no appeals on the pitch for that. And I wonder if actually they'd put a bit more pressure on the ref late on the game by doing that. And maybe they think about it a bit more. And the same for the drop ball. I think Gibbs-White kind of as a bit of a protest about it, but no one seems to do much about it. Like, it kind of just went on without anyone really caring. Like, no one seemed to pick up on it, because Dave's right, not even just in that moment, but for the last few minutes in that period, Forest were really putting Liverpool under pressure, and that completely changes the outlook of the game. Now, Liverpool had chances throughout, obviously, and the goal was really well taken. Take nothing from it. It was a whole 2 minutes afterwards. But you have changed the whole face of injury time, really, by making that decision.
Yeah, Forest were in the ascendancy, weren't they, at that point? And you could see them either pushing for a goal or at least getting a draw out of it, which would have been something they hadn't predicted at the start. But they fought really hard. And I think the momentum at that stage of a game is important. So to award an uncontested drop ball to Liverpool in that circumstance, I mean, Liverpool will argue that there was still a good couple of minutes before the goal was actually scored after the restart. So I think I can see why they'd say, well, it's on Forest really to defend at that point, and it's on them to shut the doors and to stop Liverpool from creating that chance. But from going all the way towards from Forest knocking on Liverpool's door to literally being flipped on its head changes everything, doesn't it, Dave? I mean, in some ways, I think they can look back at that and think, well, that's something amiss there. That's not quite right, is it?
Absolutely, sir. And it's another absolute gutting result for them in that those circumstances again, where they come so close to getting the point, where I don't think many people would have given them the chance against Liverpool with how well they've been grinding results out of late, even with all the injuries they've had. But I think they had the better chances in this game. Alanga had two absolutely brilliant chances. The first one, for me, I think he's got to create in a better angle for him on his favoured foot. He actually brings it onto his left. And the position that he ends up, if you have a look, he's pretty much only got one place to hit the ball, and the goalkeeper gives the goalkeeper an opportunity there to actually sort of narrow the angle.
I think it's the other way around. I think actually Kelleher's positioning was excellent. I think he, considering it's a one-on-one, did really well to push Alanga into a weird position where he didn't have much of the goal to aim at. I thought it was good goalkeeping that.
Well, I was going to say, from a Liverpool perspective, it's kind of an example of really how they probably deserve a little bit of credit because a few of their players stood up for them. Kelleher's been great deputising, hasn't he? And on the whole, they've not been at their best in the last few games, but they still keep winning, still keep keeping up that title momentum as well and staying top of the table. That deserves some respect, surely, Miles.
Yeah, and actually, Forrest can't even say that they didn't see that goal coming because they had a forewarning. Only a few minutes earlier in the game, McAllister kind of floats a ball into the box and Nunez tries like a delicate header to beat the keeper and gets it just wide. And then that exact combination is what led to the winner. So, yeah, I think Liverpool obviously a couple of players came back in this game, or at least on the bench, like they had Szoboszlai to come on. Tsimikas obviously came on again and he had a good impact. So some of the more experienced players were available. That makes a big difference. But generally speaking, they kept themselves in the game. Even when Forest were trying to break them on a counter-attack, that defensive partnership of Konate and Van Dijk seems to be the thing that's keeping them going right now.
Yeah. Anything you want to add on the game, Dave, that you observed?
I think that Forest, particularly, I think the way they're managing their team has been really good. I think in terms of, if you look at, obviously, Dirk Caridi's coming in the last couple of games, and actually in this game, I thought it was much better than in the previous fixture. I think he provided quite a good threat, and he's got a bit of a different dimension, obviously a one that came on later on in the game. But it's good that they've got different options there, and all of a sudden they're getting these players back. Sangare was on the bench, obviously, this game as well. I think they're all coming back at the right time.
Well, Forest are still very much in the relegation fight, unfortunately, and despite them playing some really good football. But Luton losing to Aston Villa at Kenilworth Road 3-2 keeps them in the bottom three instead of Forest. An important win for Aston Villa too, Miles. Not least because it kind of highlighted the strength and depth of Villa's bench this season. Calling on Lucas Digne and Moussa Diaby at a time when they did really changed the momentum of the game, because Luton fought back in the second half. But you must be happy with those substitutions, eh?
Yeah, absolutely, because we've been talking for so long about the injuries that Villa have suffered this season and how depleted the squad is. But that depth is what you need to get you over the line in a season like this, particularly if you want to be competing at the top end. So very often we see those two exact substitutions, that Bailey comes off and Diaby comes on, and it's just a fresh pair of legs to tire out that fullback. And really often Moreno comes off for Digne. So it was nice to see that come to fruition in this game and pay off for the goal, because that squad has a lot of talent in it, and I hope that they hold on to as much of it as possible, because now they sit 11 points above Man United, and if fifth does get you Champions League, I'd like to say it's almost wrapped up for Villa based on this win.
Yeah, well, I think it was a game that really tested their resolve, because I feel like at 2-0 up at half-time, they were kind of a bit complacent for large parts of the second half, especially to begin with. And I think Luton sensed that. They came back with a renewed sense of fight, didn't they, Dave, really, which has kind of characterised the way they've been trying to stave off relegation and separated themselves from the other promoted teams this season just by that spirit. It almost paid off, didn't it? That second half fight back was quite impressive.
I definitely feel that the injury to Amari Bell actually disrupted them somewhat, to lose him so early on in that first half, and then to have to readjust an area of the pitch where they're already struggling for injuries, to bring up Benet in then. And I think that did disrupt that back line. I'm not going to lie. I think they responded brilliantly in the second half. I thought Benet was a real threat. We know how dangerous they are at set pieces again, and they showed that as well. Winning the second balls, I thought Colton Morris's goal was, his finish was absolutely superb. And they put themselves in a position where they could have got a point or gone on to win it. They're just actually struggling, I think, just to finish games off at the minute. And I don't know whether it's lapses of concentration that we've seen on a couple of occasions. They've come really close to getting a result. The Chelsea game, where they obviously almost completed a really good comeback. And again, on this occasion, where they've just... It was actually a tale of crosses and set pieces this game. Some of the crosses were out of this world, and the stuff that was put in for Digne was brilliant from Moussa Diaby and great bench.
Well, I was thinking, first of all, isn't it? I was going to say the Doty pass for the Morris goal actually was just as good. But yeah, I think the timing of the Digne goal was superb, and Diaby's ball was brilliant.
Yeah, to be fair, so was Louise's for Watkins' second goal, like, to spot him in that area. It's funny, Dave mentioned about Luton being a threat from set pieces, and what, 4 out of the 5 goals in this game came from set pieces, because both teams seem to be really effective at using set pieces to score, but terrible at defending them. So it was a recipe for disaster, really, for both defending sides. But yeah, the creativity and the way that they deployed those sort of opportunities in the game were always going to be crucial. You know the kind of football Villa are going to play. They're going to want to move the ball and control it as much as possible. And actually, that second half, Luton didn't let them do that and made the most of the set pieces. It's good, though, that Villa were able to overcome that hurdle, because we've seen it a few times this season, actually, where Villa have taken a comfortable lead and then not been able to hold on to it. Look at the two United games, for example. Like, both of them, really, you would have expected Villa to have done better in. One of them, obviously, they had a healthy lead in. And then Forest the week before, they took a healthy lead and let Forest back into the game. So you've got to be careful of not being complacent and just passing the ball around when teams will attack you. It's just good that they've got the depth to get it over the line like they did today, this weekend even.
Let's talk about Ollie Watkins, shall we? Because obviously in the first half, it was all about him and his finishing. And as you say, both goals, two very different goals as well, but both finished superbly again. And you can't fault the service he's getting as well. That really helps. We mentioned that the other week, didn't we, about how the midfield really supports the attack brilliantly. But his finishing is on another level this season. And what's that, 16 goals now, 10 assists as well in the Premier League. Probably in line for Golden Boot if he keeps going at this rate anyway. But... I guess my question for you is, what's his ceiling? Is this his peak season? And can you see him almost displacing Harry Kane as a starter for England? Because they're two very different players, but I can see him contributing a lot to that England front line.
Yeah, I don't think he'll displace him. I think that they could rotate for certain fixtures, or at least he's a great option. Look, you never know. Like, Kane picks up an injury before the tournament. It's excellent to know you've got a striker in red hot form that could come in and replace him as almost an equal replacement right now, you'd say, because... the thing that he's contributing to this team, look, we talked earlier about how Foden and Saka are really amazing attacking outlets for England. And if you've got someone in the middle who can provide for both of those players, as well as finishing off from their creativity, well, that's exactly what you need. Mm. Watkins this season has now had more goal contributions than anyone in the league and is only two behind Erling Haaland in the Golden Boot race. So that's an incredible achievement for a player at Aston Villa. I think only three other players have ever got 16 Premier League goals or more in a season for Villa. So... yeah, this is top form from him. He's at that age where he's at the peak of his career. He's pushing to get into the Champions League with Aston Villa, which is amazing. So I think it's only up from here towards the end of the season. And then I hope that he replicates it next year when he's on Europe's biggest stage, because he ultimately will be.
I have to keep checking myself that it was only last season that Unai Emery took over from Aston Villa. It feels like some kind of weird fever dream where Villa have suddenly become world class. But it hasn't been an overnight job at all, has it, Dave? Villa's kind of rise to ascendancy has been kind of almost meticulously planned from the appointment of Emery, which we talked about in some detail. But looking at their fixtures, you know, they're playing Ajax and then Spurs for top four contention and then Ajax again. It is like some like otherworldly experience Villa fans are experiencing at the minute, isn't it? And they must be absolutely enjoying it.
It's been a rapid climb, hasn't it, to where they've got to now. If you just think where they were even 18 months ago, 2 years even. So you've got to give massive praise to Unai Emery. But yeah, you're right. I think, you know, this next week is probably the biggest week of the season and could go a long way to kind of having a big say where they're going to be. I think that game against Spurs is absolutely huge. That will be a priority, let's be honest. The Ajax game is a big, big game, and they will obviously go out to win it, and I'm sure they'll field a very strong team, but they're in a position at the minute, Villa, where they've actually got, you know, they've had a few players back. You mentioned Rudinho, who came in, made obviously a massive impact in this game. I think they'll make a couple of changes, especially with this game sandwiched in between the two on this game. I think that will give them an opportunity to reevaluate after that first Ajax game. If they don't get the result they want, they'll be able to see where they are after the Spurs game and think, okay, you know, we can adjust now.
The thing is, I'm confident that Villa will end the season very well and will claim a Champions League place. I honestly do think that, particularly if they can get the fifth place as Champions League in England. And actually, we were talking before we recorded, weren't we, that the irony is that the better Villa perform in Europe, the more likely it is that fifth will be okay in the league. So what do they prioritise? But there's 11 games left. They're 11 points clear of Man United. It's not going to be easy. Of the games they've got left, they've still got to play Spurs, Liverpool, Man City, Arsenal. They've even got West Ham away. They've got Brighton. They've got Chelsea. There's some difficult fixtures in there, don't get me wrong, particularly with a run in Europe embedded in between it. But like we started this conversation with, the strength in depth that we're seeing in attacking areas in particular, if they can get players back fit and firing like that, then I think it's only up from here. It's in Villa's hands. And that's amazing. With 11 games left, it is in our hands whether we get top four. Now, you're right, Mike. Ask me that question a year ago and I'm like 2 years ago and I'm laughing in your face. So it's fantastic. And the quality in this squad and the quality of the manager is really showing.
I'm just trying to get my head around the notion that Villa could potentially shuffle their pack and rest players against Ajax in either of the legs in a major European competition. That, for me, is the mark of progress. Because, I mean, you've got teams like Brighton, who we'll come on to in a moment, who are struggling to kind of keep up with the demands from a squad point of view. And now, there wasn't much between Villa and Brighton even a few months ago in terms of the level they were playing at. But the way they've built the squad and the players they've signed have made them equipped to deal with this. Not only challenging for top four, but for competing in Europe as well. It still blows my mind, mate. You must be thrilled.
Yeah, I just hope it doesn't hamstring us this summer with kind of profit and sustainability and FFP. And I hope we don't have to kind of shift anyone to kind of keep up with that. Obviously, the brand new kit deal with Adidas will be huge to contributing towards that. Yeah. Prize money of potentially winning a European competition and qualifying for Champions League will be huge. And that would do a lot. And that is how the future of a club is built. Like, we obviously saw how Brighton managed to invest a bit more in the summer, bringing in players like João Pedro from qualifying for Europe. Newcastle obviously are a bit hamstrung with how much money they've been spending because they're not bringing in enough. So we've got to learn lessons from that, not go over the top with it. And actually what that means is you need a coach to develop the players that are already there. Now, look at that starting 11 this weekend. How many of them were Emery signings? Well, Tielemans came in. I think that's it. That's like, oh, and Moreno. Tielemans and Moreno were the only two that started that were new since Emery's come in. So he is developing the players that are there as well. It's not I'm spending hundreds and hundreds of million. And I think he'd do that again if we got into the Champions League.
Another team that I think looking at Europe, Dave, probably as maybe a priority, I don't know, is Brighton, who, again, blows my mind that they're travelling to Rome on Thursday to face Roma. That's a big sign of their progress. But they lost 3-0 to Fulham this weekend, maybe with one eye on that fixture. But let's talk about Fulham for a moment, shall we, Dave? And their kind of, I don't know, security as a solid mid-table Premier League team. Because when they've been good this season, Fulham, they've been great. And lately, it's one man in particular who is potentially the new Alexander Mitrovic, based on style, do you think, Muniz? Do you think that's the case? Because his form at the minute is superb.
I think there's similarities there. I think if you look at it, at the first goal, Harry Wilson's goal, if you look at how well he battled and marauds through and actually, against the odds, manages to get to release the ball to Tyre Wilson. It's an absolutely superb finish. And just how great he is in the air as well. I do think there are some similarities between them. I think taking in consideration his first 10 league games this year, I think he went without a goal, didn't he? It was almost a Rasmus Højlund sort of resurgence, 5 goals in 5, and all of a sudden he should be up there for player of the month, you would think, with just how well he's performed. His second goal was absolutely superb, but he looks like a real good prospect, only 22 years of age as well.
Well, his form maybe comes about because he's deputising apparently for Raúl Jiménez. That seems a bit weird now, doesn't it, as well?
Well, I was going to say, don't you think it's interesting that his form has improved in February after Fulham went and got Amanda Breuer in January, right at the end of the month as well? So there was, no, I think it's a good thing though, like the competition for places, and he's taken it upon himself to really up his game. I think the Mitrovic comparison is actually a really good one. He's just, he's a bit quicker than Mitrovic, if anything. So that probably helps his case. There was a moment in the second half where Andreas Pereira broke through and really should have made it 3 there and then. And that, again, was Nunes back defending and winning the ball quite aggressively in his own half and launching the play. And that's the sort of tenacity that Fulham benefited from loads last season. It's the same that they've got in midfield with someone like Paulinho, who's obviously been missing the last couple of games. So for him to kind of lead the way like that, we know stylistically that's the kind of forward that Marco Silva appreciates.
I've enjoyed watching his games lately as well. I feel like, again, he's an entertaining striker to watch, how he holds up the ball and how he involves the rest of the team in play when they're going forward. And Fulham are a fascinating team generally because of how they got promoted back to the Premier League initially, relying on Mitrovic for goals. And we all kind of almost predicted a bit of a level of struggle, didn't we, for Fulham to a degree, maybe in the lower half of the table rather than battling for the top half. And they've tried to replace Mitrovic with the likes of Raúl Jiménez, who, to be fair to him, had a bit of a renaissance, didn't he, in the middle of the season and had a bit of a purple patch in front of goal. But long term, he's not the solution, is he, Dave? And I think that for me is, feels like that's why this is the natural heir to Alexander Mitrovic, because Muniz is still got age on his side. And I think for that Fulham attack seems to offer a lot more to his game than Jiménez does.
Absolutely, yeah. And I feel he really complements, I think, that front line, I think, in terms of the inventiveness that obviously Iwobi and Wilson providing, and Andres Pereira, I think, has performed really well of late. I think we've got to give a mention to, I think, in particularly in the last couple of games, obviously Payne is suspended, but I think since Salukis has come into the team, I think Fulham have been a little bit worried about that disrupting the midfield a little bit too much, but I think he performed really well at Old Trafford. And he's come into this game, and actually, even though they only had 29% possession in this game, there wasn't a massive difference in between the attempts on goal. Actually, Fulham really exposed Brighton in the areas that they knew they could, and Muniz was a massive part of that.
Do you know what's worth noting as well? I hate to rub this in a little bit, boys. Fulham are 12th right now, which might sound a bit underwhelming, but they're actually 9 points behind United in sixth. Now, bear in mind, United are 11 points behind Villa, who are fourth. They're actually closer in the league to Fulham. Like, yeah, that shows how tight that area of the table actually is, and actually how good Fulham have been lately. Like, they've missed a bit of consistency at times this season, but they're already on 35 points. Now, at the start of the season, when they begrudgingly lost Mitrovic, if you'd said to them, with 11 games left, you'll have 35 points and certainly be safe from relegation, and actually you might be able to look up the table at Europe, they'd have snapped your hand off at that. They're 4 points behind Brighton now.
Yeah, that's mad, isn't it? That the two are so
it's
close.
It's not
in the
a lot,
league.
Is it?
Mm. No. It takes a run of games and a run of wins and a run of good results like this to kind of climb. And a 3-0 swing in their favour is just what they needed, really, to kind of solidify that attack on the top 10. Another team that is firmly in that conversation, somehow, despite all the doubts cast over David Moyes, is West Ham, who, on the back of a really impressive win against Brentford and a hat-trick for Jarrod Bowen in particular last week, won 3-1 at Goodison, which is a difficult place to go, but I know we'll talk about Everton in a moment, how flimsy they've been lately. But a 3-1 win for West Ham, they left it super late, didn't they? But they're flying high still in the table, Dave. How is this possible? What's going on? This is almost like the derby between two managers that were almost going to get booed if they lost, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think they rode their luck a little bit in the game. I think Everton had some excellent chances. We'll speak about them in a minute. But, whether you like it or not, as a West Ham fan, I'm sure there'll be those out there moaning that they're still not happy with the style of play. But they're grinding out results at important moments. Obviously, in this game, I mean, the Suchet goal was ridiculous. There's a technique on that strike. They've still got players in there that can win matches. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? That they've got match winners in there who've got massive quality. Obviously, Pekatar coming back is a big one for them. But Jarrod Bowen's also been on fire of late as well. He's been, out of this world. So there's always going to be questions, I think, over the manager and the style of play. That will be an argument that will be ongoing, I'm sure, until the end of the season and probably even into the summer. But I think they've got an opportunity to finish the season really strongly.
Yeah, their position in the league is not a fluke, really. They are winning games and getting points where it's needed. And they've got players like Jarrod Bowen, who again stepped up in this game with that assist deep into added time, who I feel like is a more befitting captain than Kurt Zouma for West Ham. I don't know why. I think he just embodies everything that's good about West Ham when they are good, and is arguably a better role model than Kurt Zouma as well. But Jarrod Bowen, is he West Ham's heartbeat, do you reckon? They've got a few talented players, but he seems to be the one that stands up and gets counted miles every game, doesn't he?
Yeah, if you were in the transfer market in the summer and you were looking for a forward, Jarrod Bowen's got to be quite high on a few clubs' lists. So it'd be good for West Ham to tie him down and kind of give him that sort of responsibility and role, because he's a superb player. And actually, when he's got the better players around him as well that can read his runs and link the game, it's even better. Obviously, he went on that amazing run at the start of the season, had a few games where it looked like he wasn't quite as effective, but they're missing their creative players in Pekatar at that point. So with Pekatar, Bowen and Kudus all together, that is a frightening forward line. And you talk about what kind of style of play Moyes plays. Well, they've scored 7 goals in the last 2 games. It can't be that bad. And that seems fitting with the fact that Pekatar is back as well. So when he's got his good attacking players, West Ham plays some quite good attacking football. Seems a given. I don't know if David Moyes does, but I certainly feel vindicated by David Moyes' last couple of results, because I've been pushing to say that I think he's really criminally underrated for the job he's doing at West Ham. They are in Europe still. they're above Newcastle and Brighton, who could give the argument of being in Europe, disrupting their season still. I think they're having a phenomenal time of it, and Bowen is definitely the face of that.
I think to win against Everton as well at Goodison will feel doubly kind of satisfying for Moyes, won't it? But let's just shine the spotlight on Everton briefly, Dave, as well, because they're having a real struggle of it at the moment, aren't they? They've obviously had the news that they're on appeal, their points deduction's been reduced, which really helps them against relegation fight. But they're doing themselves no favours whatsoever, are they, with performances like this and the way they've been playing lately. Dominic Calvert-Lewin hasn't scored in God knows how many games. Beto missing a penalty. We all knew he was going to miss that as well, didn't we? It was almost like this weird air of gloom hanging over Goodison right now.
I wasn't convinced by the run-up. Soon as seen the run-up, that just doesn't look right. And it was, to be fair, Tarry only went the right way, and it was a decent save, to be fair.
He had a great game.
Yeah, he did.
He did. Made some great saves. I think particularly the one from McNeil. It was just got time. It was to make that reaction save was out of this world. And I did say, obviously, Everton had some great chances. I don't actually think they played that badly. I just think they got, they were exposed, I think, particularly at the end of the game. Conceded, obviously, as soon as Zouma scored that header, it kind of changed it a little bit. And Everton had the opportunities to go two, maybe even 3-0 ahead. Obviously, you mentioned the missed penalty. Beto had another really good opportunity. And it just seems like it's been that kind of season for Everton. They've made opportunities and they've had chances, just not been able to put them away.
I feel like Everton fans, though, are discontent with Sean Dyche, and almost in a similar vein to David Moyes. I don't feel like that's 100% deserved either, do you, Miles? I feel like Everton have had a lot against them this season. The players he's got aren't really any better than they can afford at the minute, really. They've not had anything to spend in January for obvious reasons. So are they right to be unhappy with Dyche, do you think? What do you make of the Everton situation?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because they went on that amazing run in December where they beat Forest, they beat Newcastle, they beat Chelsea, they beat Burnley. Yeah. And then they haven't won a game since. So in the last 10, they've lost 5, drawn 5. And that's the kind of form that does get you relegated. Now, obviously, they're out of the relegation zone now. They've got that opportunity to kind of kick on and pull themselves away. And the lack of a clinical nature seems to really be the problem for them right now. They don't seem to be able to find the back of the net. And obviously, for a lot of this season, Decore was providing goals. That's obviously stopped. He had a run out of the team, obviously. Calvert-Lewin obviously isn't provided to the level that we expect, and Beto hasn't really kicked on since his sign-in. How much of that do you put down to Dyche? Because they're the kind of forwards that he would like in this team. But if they're not finishing chances, he can't be on the pitch to put them in himself. No. That's the problem, isn't it? And there is some talent in this Everton squad. If they stay up this season with everything they've had to face and get that new stadium revenue coming in for next year, then I think he can elevate them slightly. But there's always going to be a ceiling for Everton until they make that progress in the first place.
Yeah, I agree financially there'll be a ceiling, but I disagree that there's talent in that Everton squad, mate. Honestly, I can't think of any players there that would be playing for the likes of, say, Fulham, for example. Can you, Dave? Who's Everton's standout player, apart from probably Decore, maybe?
Branthwaite, Onana.
Yeah. Garner's a good player. McNeil's been pretty decent.
What's happened then? Why are they not doing the business on the pitch? Because they're not functioning together as a team. These are individual players.
Doesn't feel coherent.
No.
I think even Harrison's a good squad option to have.
Yeah. So that's why I say, I'm just not sure it's the most coherent unit. I don't think that it's a very well-moulded squad. They're individually good players. And actually, I think if you put them in a lot of other teams in different systems, we'd see something work. But we saw in this game, like obviously Beto got his goal from a deep cross that went into him. But is the team really set up to play football in that way? Because that is their main outlet. It doesn't seem that successful. What that team needs, because it could play some quite slick, good football, needs a manager that's going to enable them to do that and a forward that's going to bury the chances at the end of it. And like I say, if you can't get your two strikers firing, well, it's not a great deal you can do about that other than replace them.
Well, I think they need to cash in on one of their assets, really. Like you say, there's a few pieces that just don't fit together, right? So how many of those players would get as individuals into teams elsewhere in the Premier League, higher up the table? Quite a few. Like you say, Branthwaite's got a massive future ahead of him. How much would you get for him? a huge amount. And they need that, I think, going forward, just to keep staying in the league, for example, for a start, but also finding players that will fit that centre-forward role, because that's going to be expensive, isn't it?
And Beto was meant to be that in the summer, wasn't he? He was meant to be their kind of saviour in that sort of position, because they knew Calvert-Lewin wasn't going to be consistent and fit. But then they moved on a player like Alex Iwobi, who's actually looking quite effective at Fulham. And you wonder whether they're making the right decisions throughout. Because if in the summer, for example, they do sell Branthwaite, okay, yeah, they'll get good money in for him that they can try and reinvest. But do you trust them to reinvest it in the right spots? It's a bit of a challenge. It's a funny one with Everton. There have been times this season where they've really convinced me and I've thought Dyche has really figured them out and they're going to pull away from trouble. And then this last 10 games, there's been some good results in there, don't get me wrong. And they drew with Villa and Spurs in that time. When you're not winning games, you need to get 3 points on the board eventually. Because for all of, I don't know, let's say Luton and Forest's kind of poor performances, they have enough good ones where, all right, you can draw 3 games. Forest matched that in one.
Anyway, guys, that's this week's highlights talked through. I've got one more I wanted to say we didn't even mention. That's Johan Visser's goal for Brentford. I thought it was superb. Ooh. Any other things you want to talk about before we go? Because, I mean, that for me was my highlight.
The new Champions League format has been officially confirmed today. What do you think?
It's mental, isn't it?
Mental. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure I understand it still, and I've been playing it on Football Manager for the last few seasons anyway, so I'm still not convinced I actually get it.
It feels a bit like how we eventually got used to the Nations League, or did we? It would be that kind of scenario where we're thinking of the permutations and how it's going to evolve as a competition. Anyway, that's it for this week's pod. Thanks again for tuning in, guys. If you're watching on YouTube, which I hope some of you are, please hit that subscribe button. That really helps towards the algorithm and getting other fans like you to watch our content, which is what we're aiming for at the end of the day. But until next week, when we talk about some big fixtures, guys, thank you. See you soon.